Hello and welcome to 251. In this situation, two pianists, five tunes, one podcast. And we're doing a Christmas special talking about five Christmas tunes which have been interpreted by jazz musicians since they were first released. I'm Simon Whiteside.
My name's Nick Tomlin.
Nick, I think you're going to talk about the general secular Christmas song and how it came about.
Yeah, well, towards the end of the 19th century, really, there was a move away from the kind of religious Christmas song to more secular songs with Jingle Bells is an example, really, of one of the earliest sort of Christmas tunes. Specifically in America, also around the turn of the century, there was this Christmas-themed operetta by Victor Herbert and Glenn McDonough, who had originally done The Wizard of Oz, and they wanted to sort of capitalize on that. So they produced this musical called Babes in Toyland, which was sort of based on the characters from the Mother Goose fairy tales, but there was a kind of Christmas theme, and there are a couple of specific Christmas songs from that. And that was really, really popular. That was from 1903, so that was really just around the turn of the 20th century. And then you had songs like Santa Claus is Coming to Town from 1934, which was a big hit for Eddie Cantor in the 1930s. And around this time, this is really when these kind of secular, kind of popular Christmas songs started to appear, really.
Yeah, I suppose in some respects you might say that Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite is also something which celebrates Christmas mm-hmm. at a without a religious mm-hmm. aspect. Not quite sure when that was first performed, but it was probably around the turn of the century, I would think, mm-hmm. Being the time that Tchaikovsky was writing. So yeah, it's interesting to think about where these things have emerged, because of course carols were there for a long time, although there are secular carols even in the Carols for Choirs book. There are a few which are about wassailing, mm-hmm. Which is more of a pagan thing, and of course the Christmas tree in a way is a pagan religion or whatever pagans were. I'm not sure if it was a religion. But we should get on and talk about the first of the five Christmas songs we've chosen to talk about. So after this little link, we shall do that. The first tune we're going to talk about is The Christmas Song, written by Mal Torme and Robert Wells in 1945, and probably one of the most common choices by jazz musicians. It's certainly, for me, my favourite of the Christmas songs, and it's very classy, I think, in terms of its jazz sort of credentials already, so you don't have to do much to it in order for it to sound good, if you see what I mean. And there's an interesting story about the beginning of this song. According to Mal Torme, the song was written in a blistering July of 1945, and it was more a sort of thought exercise in how to stay cool when it was very hot. And he sort of came across some lines on Wells's piano which said, chestnuts roasting, Jack Frost nipping, Yuletide carols, folks dressed up as Eskimos, as a way of, as we've said, staying cool. And he said, oh, there's a song in that. I don't think that Robert Wells had intended there necessarily to be a song. And apparently 40 minutes later they'd finished what is quite possibly the Christmas song, quite properly named. what are your thoughts on it?
Well, it's a great tune, great harmony, and quite difficult as well. I mean, it actually modulates, it moves into different keys. Very often these Christmas songs tend to be quite diatonic, they tend to stay in the same key, but this one does actually modulate it. I mean, it's one of those tunes, it's happened to me a couple of times where I've been on a gig and someone's called it and I've sort of thought, well, it's quite easy to busk, I mean, everybody knows that, and when you get to the end of that A section, you sort of have to start thinking about where you're going. But the melody itself is actually not that easy, is it, to sing? You know, it's quite challenging.
Yeah, I mean, Mel Torme is well known for having incredible musical control, and he's much more, like, in a way, like a saxophone player. He can almost sing anything, although he didn't really ever sing anything atonal. But he just, you know, had very, very good control of his voice, very good pitch, and so these octave leaps and coming down scales and going into odd keys. He was one of the best at that. And often when he did his things with Marty Paich, he would just have bass and drums, and he'd, you know, be singing quite complicated harmonic structures completely in tune over the top of quite a skeletal harmonic basis, I suppose. It does get reharmonized a bit. There's the Nat King Cole version, as it were, where the harmony kind of does this before going. Quite a lot of people do more sort of 1-6-2-5 type starts to those to that tune. And there are obviously famous versions. I already mentioned quite possibly the most famous version. We should probably talk about those, shouldn't we?
Yeah, so Nat King Cole actually recorded it quite a few times. The first one was just with his trio, without any strings, and that was in 1946. But the better-known versions are the ones with a string arrangement, which I didn't realise. I just found out from you that I always assumed it was Nelson Riddle who wrote it, but you said that probably the original wasn't Nelson Riddle, but Nelson Riddle then went on to kind of reimagine it for the later arrangements.
Yeah, I did actually find out, I should have written it down, who did the first version, because it was quite soon after the trio version, wasn't it? And
I think it was 50. I think the trio was 46, and then 53.
Yeah,
was the next.
Well, I actually think there's a recording we don't know that no one hears that was before that 53 recording.
Okay,
but I might be wrong. But it has become an absolute classic introduction,
sort of iconic.
And very beautifully recorded and very beautifully played. It's got a cozy sort of feel, hasn't it? The whole arrangement, and it's not over saccharine. Sometimes string arrangements become very sort of reverb drenched affairs, where it all gets a bit over lush. But I think the Nelson Riddle had a good sense of space, I think, with strings. Ballad strings are easier than strings on faster tunes, anyway. But other versions that you like? Have you got any?
Well, I suppose we should say Mel Torme himself recorded it quite a few times, including up until, I think, 1992 was the last time he actually recorded it. Sinatra obviously recorded it in 1957. Ella Fitzgerald did a really nice version of it in 1960. Even James Brown did a version of it in 1966.
Yes, so, not one I'm super familiar with. I mean, you were saying in our discussions before the podcast that you'd found on that secondhand songs site that there were a considerable number of recordings.
Yeah, 1,400 cover versions to date of this tune.
And that's licensed ones.
Yes, that's just licensed ones, yes, exactly.
So there could well be plenty of unlicensed ones out there as well. I mean, it's a standard sort of 32-bar form. AABA. It's good. It's got a good tension. The middle section's quite nice, and got that really interesting end of the A section. But it does lead back logically, doesn't it?
It doesn't sound forced or kind of.
Presumably, that Mel Torme. I mean, he's. I think he's quite underrated, Mel Torme, if I'm honest, because you know his greatest work happened to coincide with Sinatra's greatest work. And he recorded quite a lot of the same tunes that Sinatra recorded at the same time. And, you know, also he has written, this is one of the absolute Christmas classics. But most people, if you say Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire or The Christmas Song,
think of Nat King Cole.
They think, oh, that's that Nat King Cole song, yeah. So, The only other thing we should probably mention here is the music theory version of this song. Would you like to give us a little thought on that?
Yeah, so somebody, I don't know who it was, some clever person came up with the idea of basically rewriting the lyrics to sort of explain the melodic intervals in the song. So instead of chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, it's been changed to octave moving to the mediant, major sixth stepping down to do, and the whole song has been rewritten in this way. So it's quite
definitely one to check out on YouTube. Yeah. The other thing we should say is that we've got on our 251 Facebook page, there's both Spotify and Apple Music playlists for all these tunes in multiple versions. I quite like, I put on the Jacob Collier version of the Christmas song.
He did that quite recently, didn't he?
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. Mm. But you know, it's a standard. Mm. What is now now a Jacob Collier thing, which is impressive, but it's quite funny actually. His version, for me anyway, it's got some sort of little swoopy high falsetto sort of singing moments with little falls, which I quite like. The other thing we should say is that if you like the weight of that early and iconic arrangement turns up in quite a lot of people's versions, and in fact even Gregory Porter's version, which I think he's got a great voice and sings it really well, but at the introduction and the string chart is, you know, more than a nod to the original. Great. Well, we will go on to our next tune, which is Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas was written in 1943 by the songwriting team of Hugh Martin and Rolf Blaine, and it was written for the film Meet Me in St. Louis, which was a musical directed by Vincent Minnelli. And in the film, the song is sung by Judy Garland, who plays the character Esther. And the film, it really just deals with a year in the life of this family in this small town. And I suppose the kind of the plot climax comes when the father of the family gets a job in New York, and it seems as if the family are going to have to move to New York and leave St. Louis, and they love this town. And that at that point, Esther sings this song to her five-year-old sister, Tutti, to sort of cheer her up because they're, you know, this move to New York and she's upset. And that's the kind of the setting of the song, really. But the song kind of went through some changes, really, because the original was just thought to be too depressing. I think originally the idea was that she was going to say that we have to remember this Christmas because next year Christmas we're not going to enjoy it because we're going to be in New York, and I think the producers just sort of felt this was too depressing, so they actually asked him to change the lyrics. And I mean, the original lyrics are quite dark. I mean, so the original first lines were, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It may be your last. Next year, we may all be living in the past." So, not exactly a kind of cheerful Christmas song.
Or maybe suitable for this year.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, then he was persuaded to change the lyrics to "Let your heart be light. Next year, all our troubles will be out of sight." And obviously the song then took on a slightly different meaning.
I think it finished at number 75 in the all-time 100 years of Christmas songs.
Mm.
I think that was a judged in 2004, so quite how they managed to do 100 years when it was only written in 1944, I don't know. But so it is, again, one of the ones that turns up on lots of people's Christmas albums.
Mm.
And at the end of this podcast, Nick, I think we should discuss our favourite sort of albums as well as songs here. It's another AABA, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which means eight bars repeated, and then a contrasting eight bars, and then the first eight bars, normally with a slight change at the end, to wrap it up. Which is always quite a good format, and very common in sort of 32 bar show tune type formats. And it's got some good opportunities for this is the, whereas the Christmas song hasn't necessarily had a lot of reharmonization, this one does get quite a lot of treatment, doesn't
yeah.
it, from people?
I guess because it's essentially quite simple. I mean it's a beautiful tune, and I really like it. It's among my favorite Christmas songs. But it's, you know, the melody's quite diatonic, which kind of lends itself very often to reharmonization. And the harmonies themselves, and compared with the Christmas song, are quite straightforward, aren't they, really?
Yeah,
you know?
It's very much around the cycle, isn't it? 1-6-2-5 type arrangements. What I tend to have noticed is that if the A section is quite complicated, then the B section isn't, in order to be a contrast.
Yeah.
Whereas in this song, it's the other way around. It's like the B section is slightly more interesting than the A section harmonically, in a way.
Yeah.
Going
yeah.
to a sort of minor and coming out of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, on this Secondhand Songs, there's over 1,500 cover versions to date of this song. So, in fact, more than the Christmas song.
Yes. I mean, I suppose it's that doesn't necessarily count as performing either.
No,
I mean,
that's
recording.
Yes, that's recordings, yes. Yeah.
So it may be more recorded, that's true.
Mm.
But it's definitely one of the top three, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Are there any other versions that you particularly like?
Well, I suppose we should also say that, Frank Sinatra, he recorded it quite a few times. Again, you know, did sort of really good versions, but he also changed some lyrics. He thought it was he still thought it was a bit too miserable. There's a line towards the end. It says next year we will all be together if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. And Frank Sinatra didn't particularly like this, so he had it changed to "Hang a shining star upon the highest bough."
Mm.
And in fact, a lot of people, they tend to sing both, don't they? So they'll kind of the first time through they'll sing. Until yeah. then, we'll have to muddle through. And then when they sing it again at the end, they kind of, you know, sing the "Hang a shining star" line.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does. The people who do alter versions that alter the lyrics, particularly if they become well-known, like the Frank Sinatra version is well-known, it does give you the opportunity then to do, as a singer, to do, if you like, two versions on the way in and the way out, or a second chorus with a slightly extends your vocal moment at the beginning of the song. Very good. Well, we're going to move on to an Irving Berlin tune next. White Christmas was written by Irving Berlin in 1942, and it's the other 32-bar song form, A, B, A, C, which means that the first eight bars and the third eight bars are very similar, but it has two different endings. Normally the B leads you back to the... leaves you hanging, waiting for the resolution, going back to the A, whereas the C section will finish off back in the home key. And although it's listed as 1942, some people say that he might have written it as early as 1940. He was staying in a hotel at that point in La Quinta, California, and it was a similar sort of thing, but it was quite hot.
It always seems to be summer, don't it, when they write these songs.
Well, I mean, to be fair, if you're going to do a Christmas album, you do have to record it in August. You can't. There's no point in recording it at Christmas unless you want to release it next year. The Arizona Biltmore Hotel also claims that the song was written there. So he'd stayed up all night and then told his secretary, "I want you to take this song down. I wrote it over the weekend. Not only is it the best song I ever wrote, it's the best song anybody ever wrote." He was always quite modest, Irving. Of course, really, most people know it from the films that it appeared in. There's a film called White Christmas, but in fact, the first version of that film, as it were, is called Holiday Inn, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And Bing Crosby sings it in that film.
Mm.
Have you got any sort of historical things to add?
Well, it's interesting that it's kind of, it's a duet, actually, isn't it? I mean, in the film, if you watch the version from Holiday Inn, it's with the actress Marjorie Reynolds, although I think, as was very commonly happened, her voice was dubbed, wasn't it, by another singer in the film. But it's quite nice the way it's done in the film. They do it as a kind of a duet. It's almost like he's teaching her the song, isn't he? He sort of sings it and then he kind of tells her the words so she can sing it. And yeah, it's quite interesting, that version.
That the film is a kind of musical within a musical type.
Yes, yeah.
It's a musical about doing musicals,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah.
And certainly I've seen versions recently of this film and White Christmas where the slightly dubious blackface scene has been cut out.
Oh, right.
But there was a blackface scene in the original. And that's certainly been from broadcast version, you know, live broadcast versions, as it were, that I think that scene gets cut.
Mm-hmm.
The first version, of course, was 42.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's considered to be from that year.
Mm.
Of course, the film White Christmas was 54, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, that was later, yeah.
So... What are there any particular versions that you like?
Well, I suppose the classic jazz version is the recording that was made in 1948 by Charlie Parker, and it was done. It was actually a radio broadcast on Christmas Day from the Royal Roost, which was a jazz club in New York, introduced by Symphony Sid. And if you listen to the version, Symphony Sid is this kind of he was a radio host, wasn't he? A famous radio host at that time. He sort of introduces the band, and it's all done very kind of off the cuff. But it's a great band. It's Kenny Dorham, Benny Green on trombone, Al Haig piano, Tommy Potter bass, Max Roach drums, obviously Charlie Parker on sax, and they do it as kind of like a medium swing. And he plays a great solo. I mean, you know, it's not often you hear a bad solo from Charlie Parker. You know, he quotes Jingle Bells, and it's all in good spirits.
Yes, I mean, he didn't. I think, like Bill Evans, there's only one bit of evidence of him playing a Christmas song, isn't there? Which did get onto our playlist, even though it's not one of our songs that we're talking about. But I think that's the only Christmas song I've heard Charlie Parker play, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's quite an interesting little gem there. The quoting of Jingle Bells we'll talk about, but of course it happens at the end of the famous Christmas song version of Nat King Cole's With String, doesn't it, on the guitar?
Yeah, I wonder if that's the first sort of first time it appears, because it's now become a cliche, hasn't it? It's sort of when ever anybody finishes a Christmas song, they tend to do a little kind of Jingle Bells quote at the end.
Yes, well, you know, the hip members of the fraternity play it as a Lydian dominant, don't they? So you play it a triad up,
right? Yeah.
So you're playing it, but it's a little bit less cheesy.
Yes, yeah.
playing, you know, dominating on the sharp 11 sort of thing. But yes, it does seem to turn up a lot. And of course, there's that Joni Mitchell song, her sort of famous Christmas song. Is it called I Wish I Had a River? I'm not sure what the actual title is.
But it
starts with her playing a piano part which sounds like it's going to be Jingle Bells.
Oh,
and
yes,
then isn't.
That's right. Yes, yeah.
You know,
it's called River. Is it River? River, I think. Yes, yeah, yeah.
But that's another instance of that kind of being quoted in, or alluded to, I suppose. The one that I really like, and I think probably it's from because I've watched Home Alone so many times, is the Drifters version, which is not actually a jazz version, but it is doo-wop, I suppose, is a related popular sort of jazzy music, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they have that nice little sort of do-do-do-do-do going on as a backing little figure while the tune goes at the top. But there's also some brilliant moments where the high tenor does some pretty incredible vocal gymnastics.
Mm.
And it's the scene where
Macaulay Culkin.
Well, that's him. Too many syllables, Mr. Mozart. He's singing away with his toothbrush or something as a microphone, and then he ends up putting his dad's aftershave on. And
oh yes, yeah, yeah.
It's the famous shot.
From
the film. With many Irving Berlin songs, that they do, they're kind of more plain vanilla than some other jazz songs, aren't they?
Mm.
And I think it's had quite a lot of interpretations because of that. It gives players a lot of opportunity to change the harmony, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Although it's very interesting, the melody, isn't it? How, you know, the first sort of five notes, it's just basically chromatic, a sort of chromatic little sort of decoration, isn't it? Which is quite unusual, really, I think, to start a song like that.
It's almost like the bebop noodle, isn't it? I'm going to play one note, but I'm going to play the three or four notes around it.
So that kind of, you know, I've heard that dealt with in different ways, because obviously it's, you know, you've got notes outside of the chord note, you know, to deal with.
Again, it's a Christmas nostalgia song, isn't it? And the 40s and 50s seem to produce these particular... I think it was really the effect of the Second World War.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that had a lot to do with the popularity of these songs. Same with Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, because that was... That came out just, I mean, during the Second World War, didn't it? And
yes, well, I mean, this was also obviously 42, so anything after 39 and before 46, I suppose, really, would count as... quite a lot of these things were also made for V-discs, weren't they, to sort of give or performed by the I can't remember what the American version of it's called, but, you know, the sort of performing... troupe that people like Bob Hope and Marilyn Monroe.
In fact, Bing Crosby performed it just a few weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor in a Christmas Day broadcast, actually. And he said, he was asked by an interviewer sort of later what was one of the hardest things he had to do in his career. And he said that he had to sing White Christmas to an audience of 100,000 GIs who were all kind of in tears. This was in France in 1944. Just before the Battle of the Bulge, and without actually breaking down himself, you know, he said that was probably the hardest thing he had to do.
Yes, it's called the USO, isn't it? That's how to remember.
Oh yes, yes, yeah, the entertainment sort of section of the.
Yeah, no, and that was certainly, I think, the effect of the Second World War on people. You know, maybe this year we'll also have a bumper crop of. Nostalgic songs or next year. Great. Well, we could move on to our next song now.
Winter Wonderland was written in 1934 by Felix Bernard and Richard Smith, better known as Dick to his friends. And they're not a particularly well-known writing team, although actually Felix Bernard... did in the 1930s, he wrote for people like Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, and Sally Bowles. Although this is by far his best known song, and I was quite surprised at how early this song was. I somehow thought it was from the 40s or 50s, but it actually goes back to 34. This song, and apparently Smith was inspired to write the lyrics after seeing Honesdale Central Park, which is in Pennsylvania, where he lived. He saw it in the snow, and he was inspired to write these lyrics. But they're actually written while he was receiving treatment for TB. He contracted tuberculosis, and he was actually in West Mountain Sanatorium in Scranton, where he was being treated when he wrote the song. And sadly, he actually died of TB fairly soon after. He was only 34. In 1935, he died of TB, which is quite sad, but so that's kind of the little story around the writing of this song.
Well, it's another one of those Christmas songs where it's been deemed to be a little bit too risque.
Yeah, it's funny what was considered racy in 1934.
And it's another one of those songs where often singers will do two different versions of the main chorus. And there's a sort of children's lyric in there.
Well, yeah.
But of all the Christmas songs, to me, this is one of the more interesting ones lyrically, because it's talking about something that isn't actually... It's a song set at Christmas.
Yeah, It's not specifically a Christmas song, really.
No, in a way, it's just a love song.
Mm.
And it's got some... I mean, I'm a sucker for the internal rhyme and the great pun.
Mm.
And I love the last A section, they have, "Later on we'll conspire as we sit by the fire," which is a great bit of rhyming. And basically it's a couple saying we're going to get married, isn't it?
Yeah, or sort of pretending they were getting married. Maybe that was where the controversy sort of came in. But the snow, you know, the snowman is the vicar, isn't he? And it's sort of
yes. They can pretend it's Parson Brown, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, again, it's snowman. In the meadow, we will build a snowman and pretend that he is Father Brown.
Mm.
We'll say, "Are you busy?" He'll say, "No, man." Which I like.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are quite a few... I think... didn't Stevie Wonder do a version of this?
Yes, he did, yeah.
I mean, the people do sometimes sort of muck around with some of these lyrics, which are interesting. For example, at the end of the Christmas song, where some people often will repeat that, "Merry Christmas... Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas to you."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I often sing, "Merry Christmas, meet the Flintstones." "Merry Christmas to you." So sometimes people will stick in their own little topical things sometimes as well. You know, you may have found if Ray Gelato and his Giants were allowed to do their Christmas run, which sadly they've not now been cancelled because of London going into Tier 3, Ray will often slightly alter things due to, I'm sure there would have been some COVID references. Corona, my Corona. I find that quite interesting that it's actually really a kind of a love song. I suppose in some respects it's similar to "Baby, It's Cold Outside," isn't it? It's that we're you know, do I have to go? Do I have to? You're going to really chuck me out. Of course, we do forget that the 60s sexual revolution did change everything in terms of what was acceptable and what was seen to be, you know, people stepping out and courting, words like that.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose also pop music's become increasingly more sexualized, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So this doesn't seem anything at all to us, but at the time, particularly in the 30s, might have been more risque.
Mm.
Although, having said that, yeah, that's all really public broadcast, isn't it? Because certainly on what used to be called the Race Records side of things, which there were some extremely explicit lyrics, or at least undoubted, you know, very simple to decode double entendres.
Yes. Yeah.
One of my favourites being the "All the Girls Like My Big 10-inch," which is about the record size, apparently. That is debatable. So, do we have more to say, or
maybe just talk about briefly about the different versions? I mean, the first, it was first recorded by Richard Himber and his Ritz-Carlton Orchestra.
Oh yeah, of course, yes.
With Joey Nash singing the vocal part. And it was actually recorded. There was an RCA Victor session that Himber did, and there was some spare time in the studio. So they decided to record this. So they used the RCA Victor Orchestra and sort of expanded it with some session musicians who were around, including Artie Shaw, which I didn't know. So Artie Shaw is actually on the original, the first version of this. But then obviously over the years there have been many recordings. I think the first time I heard it was my dad was a big Johnny Mathis fan, and
He did a very well known one.
Yeah, he had the sort of the compilation of Johnny Mathis. So when I was a kid, when I was sort of playing through my parents' record collections, I specifically remember hearing Johnny Mathis sing this. That was he recorded it many times, I think. The version, I really like the Ray Charles version, which pops up in When Harry Met Sally, film in 1985. And I remember trying to find it when I heard it and really liked it. And this was in sort of pre-internet days. Trying to track it down was really hard. He made a Christmas album in 1985, Ray Charles, and he did a version on there, which I really like.
I mean, that's something we'll talk about because at the end we're going to have a discussion about albums, aren't we, that we like.
Yeah.
But It seems to me that, for example, there's a Dave Brubeck Christmas album, and it strikes me as odd that quite a lot of these really big people, as it were, big names, didn't record a Christmas album until very late. I think it's possibly 80s or 90s that Brubeck recorded his Christmas album. So, yeah, it's quite a weird one, isn't it? Are there any other... I mean, Chet Baker did a version, didn't he? And there's a Ramsey Lewis's trio version is quite a good one. And then that album itself is quite an interesting album, isn't it?
I don't know if I know that. Ramsey Lewis Christmas.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting album. I mean, there's some... Obviously, we'll talk about this after we've done our final tune. But, yeah, there are quite a lot of interesting ones out there. Well, I think I've said all I can say about Winter Wonderland.
Yep.
And we can go on to our final tune.
The last Christmas song we're going to talk about is actually of German origin. And the German title is O Tannenbaum, which has been translated into O Christmas Tree. And this is a by far the earliest song that we're looking at. And it's kind of a Christmas carol, although again it's not really about Christmas. It's really just about the Christmas, well, the tree, the fir tree, and then obviously the fir tree became the Christmas tree. So it has become a sort of Christmas song almost by default, hasn't it, really? And it's a very old melody, and the melody itself has been used for many other songs. One of the most famous being the Red Flag, which is the song of the English Labour movement. But it's also been used. There's a whole list on the Wikipedia page of songs which it's been used for, basically, this melody.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those folk songs that has ended up being repurposed lots of times. I mean, the modern lyrics for what we're talking about as a Christmas-y, Christmas-type song, that was 1824, I think, wasn't it? And it was an organist from Leipzig, who sort of wrote it down as a Christmas song.
But it was specifically about the fir tree, wasn't it? About its everlasting, you know, its evergreen properties, and I think that's the...
Well, students of German literature will know that trees are incredibly important in the German literature psyche and the German psyche. So the Linden tree, particularly, as a sort of Schubert wrote a song called The Linden Tree in one of his song cycles, but also the kind of Black Forest, and trees are very significant in German literature and culture for some reason. The Tree of Life, for example, in Wagner's Ring. So I think when Germans are just talking about a tree, in a way there's a level of cultural understanding what that's referring to on a more deeper level. But yeah, it is fundamentally more about the symbol of that, I suppose. And of course, Christmas trees, we think of Christmas trees as, you know, age old, but that Victorian times was really when Christmas trees started to be brought back into the house. Although they had been brought into the house before that, the kind of trend of it being a thing you do really only dates back, certainly in the West, Britain and America, to the Victorians. And I think it was partly to do with the Industrial Revolution was quite brutal in terms of deforestation. And I think bringing in a Christmas tree was a sort of nostalgic element to a certain extent. But also, that's when mass printing started to be much cheaper. And so Christmas cards became a thing much more. And, you know, the Coca-Cola Santa relationship, which we could debate, but certainly the concept of a Father Christmas and how he looked and presents under trees and those sorts of images started mm-hmm. to appear. And snow, of course, is very centred on Christmas, but there's plenty of places around the world that don't have snow at Christmas. So, you know, it's the middle of the Australian summer, for example.
Mm.
But, of course, we're talking about it in terms of a jazz mm-hmm. jazz playing scenario, and there are quite a lot of it. We wanted to choose one carol, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are plenty of examples.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one that does get the treatment. And I think you've got a particular version that you would like to talk about.
Yeah, I thought a good example is Vince Guaraldi, his performance of it. And this is also obviously to do with the Charlie Brown Christmas, which was made in the 1960s. Basically, Vince Guaraldi was a pianist. He was a West Coast pianist, and he played with people like Cal Tjader. And in 1962, he recorded an album of Jobim tunes, but which also included an original by him called Cast Your Fate to the Wind, which became a kind of unexpected hit, really. Mm. And that brought him to the notice of this guy called Lee Mendelssohn, who was actually making a documentary about Charles Schulz's Peanuts cartoon strip.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this idea of commissioning Guaraldi to write some original jazz music for the documentary, which he did, although actually the documentary was shelved. It was never shown. But this idea of using Guaraldi continued when they decided to make Schulz and Mendelssohn decided to make a Christmas special of the Charlie Brown comic strip, which became a Charlie Brown Christmas. And Guaraldi contributed three originals. So there was Christmas Time Is Here, Skating, and Linus and Lucy, which is maybe his best known of the Charlie Brown tunes. But he also recorded a few jazz versions of Christmas carols, including O Tannenbaum. And yeah, that's the version which I thought it'd be quite good to look at.
Yeah. I mean, it's there was an interesting theory put forward by Ted Yeo, which was that one of the reasons that jazz has survived to a certain extent is that when we grew up, there was a lot of jazz in what we were given as children for TV. For example, Sesame Street has a lot of jazz in it,
mm-hmm.
but particularly Peanuts, proper jazz, as it were, kiddified jazz.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, you know, we just accepted it, didn't we? It was what was there. And I thought that's quite an interesting point, because certainly, I mean, even, you know, the teacher talking in Charlie Brown cartoons is a trombone pixie mute and a plunger.
No, there's definitely a sort of jazz sensibility throughout the whole thing, really. It's kind of
I mean, and also if you think about it, particularly in animation, there's a lot in animation, and Walt Disney's music department had its own jazz band, didn't it? Animation department had its own jazz band with Walt. What's his name? Ward Kimber was the sort of driver of that, the Firehouse Five band. He was a very extrovert trombonist, and yeah, they had their kind of zany comedy sort of side of things as well. But yeah, I thought that was an interesting point, that perhaps one of the problems, I guess SpongeBob has jazz, although it's kind of Hawaiian jazz. I've certainly heard versions of I can't remember which rag it is, someone will tell us what that is. But yeah, there's some interesting little bits of, snuck in culture in kids' programming.
Yeah.
So have you got any sort of specific things you'd like to say about the...
Yeah, so I thought it might be worth just looking at what's involved in kind of jazzifying, for want of a better word, a carol. I mean, the original song is very kind of... it's a hymn, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
So,
Thank you.
it's just 1-5-1-5, really.
Yeah.
So what Grialdi does is he kind of just adds lots of extra chords, which is what jazz musicians tend to do when they're reharmonizing a song. He sort of, first of all, he plays it as a waltz, and then it goes into a kind of 4-4 swing. But he basically just adds a lot more harmony. So his version is something like... And he uses this nice, which is it's an 11 flat 9 chord, a very jazzy chord, which gives it a nice flavour. And then they really go on to perform it as a sort of jazz tune. They take solos. I mean, I've got to say, Vince Grialdi plays really well. I mean, whenever you hear him interviewed or read interviews, he's always seems to be quite humble about his piano playing, but he was actually a really good player, quite Bill Evans in a way. He was obviously influenced by Bill Evans, but it's a really nice solo he takes on this, I think. Really nice kind of double time stuff. He's got a really nice touch.
I agree. I mean, I think he is one of those off the radar pianists.
Mm.
But then, of course, he was up against, like you say, Bill Evans and all those people around that time, who certainly it was a market full of incredible players.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, one of the things I put library music up onto a platform called Audio Jungle, and I did 3 Christmas tunes that I put up this year as jazzy Christmas tunes, which I renamed using sort of my love of Jive Talk, and so Dig That Christmas Twig is my version of Oh Christmas Tree, but. But I start with things like, you know, so you can have that. Don't know exactly what I always sort of think of that as something like a Phrygian chord, but it's basically a sharp 11, major 7, a semitone away from the root, with the root on the top as well. If anyone wants to decode that, but there are quite a lot of options. To just because the melodies are often very diatonic, as you've said, and they don't have a big compass, so they're not going from very low to very high, and you can then therefore, you know, in the kind of that one note can be reharmonized in lots of different ways. And that was just one of them, or several of them. But you know, there are many, many more. So you can get quite creative jazz-wise on tunes which have fairly simple melodies. And I suppose one of the dangers. There are a few people. There's a guy out there who does these kind of various levels of jazzing of something, and he did some Christmas tunes where he reharmonizes his reharmonizations until they become, you know, it becomes too much, as it were. So it's a question of, I suppose, taste as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But perhaps we'll talk about that now when we sum up this Christmas episode with a talk about approaches and albums that we like and various general sort of Christmas album discussion. So our final section today, we're just going to have a little discussion about Christmas albums that we like. But I'd like to start out, well, these are Christmas albums that I like as well, in fact, but I'd like to start out by kind of highlighting the difference between two new releases by British jazz players. One is the Gabriel Atchin Trio, which he's brought out a very classy set of tunes played in a very classy way. And also there's a sort of slight quiz going on, because he's treating each tune as a different pianist, if you like, almost like a piano impersonator, if you like, saying, you know, this. There's a Bill Evans one and a Thelonious Monk one and a Barry Harris one. Although, of course, it's all packaged, if you like, in his own sort of bop credentials within. So that they are very similar, but also there are some subtle differences. And I think probably the Bill Evans one is one of the most obvious versions. But it's really interesting how... And that set of tunes that he's come up with are very much the top choices, if you like. And then you contrast that with The Piano Man at Christmas, which is Jamie Cullum's new Christmas album, which I think there are 12 songs on it. And his idea was to try and, as a songwriter more than as a jazzer in a way, to add some songs to try and, you know, meet the high standards, I suppose, because Christmas songs are really good, aren't they? Quite a lot of them. And you know, obviously some pretty terrible ones out there, but the ones that have survived are very good songs. And his are all originals. And certainly his the one that's being released as single is very, very good. And I've been seeing adverts for them on Sky and things, so it's being pushed pretty heavily. Shout out to Gabriel. I think he's done a really great job on his trio album. It's really very classy.
I saw a review in Downbeat, no less so. Word seems to be spreading, which is good.
I know he also got a very nice comment from Herbie Hancock, which is never bad as a jazz pianist. Especially as Herbie Hancock is one of the people he's referencing. So it would be bad if he said, I hate this. but there's, you know, I highly recommend people who are really into mid-century pianists, such as, sort of Kenny Drews and Sonny Clarks that we've done our previous two series on. There's a lot to be had from that trio album. And obviously Jamie Cullum's album is also very good, very different, more kind of big bandy, I suppose. Arrangements by Tom Richards, which are really great. And recorded, and then there's some string stuff on there, I think, as well. But, recorded at Air Studios and Abbey Road Studios, so top quality stuff. For me, the other Christmas albums that I really like... I really like Diane Reeves' Christmas album. It's got a lot of really nice tunes on. It's what's become the open studio kind of people, really, because she always played Peter Martin as our pianist, but also there's the Latin people that are involved, like I can never remember. I always want to say Guy Lombardo, but that's someone else. the guitarist. There's some really nice Latin versions of tunes with a real Latin American guitarist, not a if you like a jazz player who's doing Latin. This is someone who actually that's their bag. And for me also the George Shearing Quintet one is really interesting. It's got a lot of, you know, there's a lot of him in it, of course, but also it is quite inventive the way they approach the tunes. Have you got some to add that you'd like to put in there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of maybe slightly more obscure ones. One of my favourites is it's not really a Christmas album, but it's the Duke Ellington version of Nutcracker Suite. He did a kind of rearrangement of Nutcracker Suite, which I think you can buy in. There's like a compilation of three short suites on CD. You can buy it as a sort of part of that collection, and it's brilliant. I mean, just very, you know, it's kind of Christmassy, but it's beautiful big band writing and playing as well. Obviously, it's Duke Ellington.
Do you know when that was? I'm wondering if it coincided with one of the writing bands.
I'm not sure. I'm guessing it was 60s.
Later.
Yeah, it could even be. I'm not sure.
Because quite a lot of classical music got jazzed, as it were, when there were the writers ASCAP.
Oh, okay.
Writers' bands. Yeah, where they record new stuff.
Yeah.
That was in the 40s.
Yeah, I think it was later. I may be wrong, but yeah.
I have to say that's not one I'd...
It's worth listening to. It's really, really good. And also, another, again, it's not really a jazz, sort of pure jazz one, but the Take Six, they did a Christmas. I think it's just called Take Six Christmas, and it's the one, I think it's from the 90s, early 90s. But anybody who's into Jacob Collier, you know, have a listen to where he's really coming out of. And Take Six, they just do some basic a cappella arrangements of some Christmas carols, and they're just absolutely beautiful. Mm. And... you know, tasteful, and yeah, so I'd definitely recommend that as well.
Well, if you want to go untasteful, there's Freshmas, which is the Four Freshmen's Christmas album, which I cannot really recommend, although I do like the Four Freshmen, particularly the and albums, i.e. and five saxes and five trumpets, four trombones, those sorts of things. They're really good versions, but they're 50s versions. I think the Freshmas might have been a 70s monstrosity. But there are some good sort of jazz players albums. So Oscar Peterson did a Christmas album. You know, as you said earlier, with someone else, there's very little, with Charlie Parker, there's not a lot of bad Oscar Peterson. And Duke Pearson did one, which is quite interesting.
I don't know that one. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's pretty good. That's a nice one. There's obviously the Ella Fitzgerald, Ella Wishes You a Swinging Christmas.
That's kind of classic, isn't it? Yeah.
That's a really good one. Wynton Marsalis did one. I included O Christmas Tree, his version of O Christmas Tree, on our set list. That is a kind of out-and-out trad version. It's got an absolutely brilliant banjo solo on it. And I mean that sincerely. It really is a very good banjo solo. Top quality triple strumming going on there. But it's not all in a more New Orleans style. Some of it is, but some of it's a bit more in his modern style, which is quite an interesting mix. Charlie Bird did quite a nice Christmas album. And one person I'd never heard of before, but I included his O Christmas Tree because it's interesting, was a guy called Warren Wolf.
He's a vibes player, isn't he? Quite a young vibes player.
Yeah. He's new to the scene, isn't he? That's why perhaps I hadn't.
That's quite a recent album, isn't it? That he did a Christmas album.
Okay. Yeah, I hadn't come across him before, with that one, I hadn't really sort of gone into what you know, and any detail on it, looking at it. Then that people like Brubeck, he did a solo piano. I didn't listen to all the albums, so there may be some trio on there, but everything I clicked on, it was solo piano versions of Christmas tunes, which are quite nice. And of course, what we have already mentioned, I think, possibly already mentioned, the one Christmas tune Bill Evans recorded, Santa Claus Is Coming to Town, which is on that Trio 64, I think.
Yes,
isn't
it is, yeah.
Which is an interesting one. And Carmen McRae, actually, there's a good compilation of Christmas songs. And Carmen McRae did a version of the Christmas song on that, which is really good. I was trying to find a Carmen McRae album, thinking perhaps she had done one, or in the hope that, because she's always quite an inventive singer, isn't she? I could only find this compilation that contained one by her. Have you got any to add, or are we ready to...
I think we're about ready to wrap up.
Yes. How fitting. time to wrap. Well, thank you very much for all those of you who've been listening to our podcasts, and this is just our little Christmas offering. And so, from me, Simon Whiteside, I say Merry Christmas.
And from me, Nick Tomlin, Merry Christmas.